وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Jenin in the occupied West Bank has been the scene of Palestinian deaths. Another Palestinian succumbed to his wounds, raising the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday to 4. Why are Israeli forces given the free hand to kill Palestinians in such a manner? And is a full-scale and major confrontation with the occupying Israeli regime ready to spark at any time? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight.
There is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The regime has intensified its brutal tactics across the West Bank and Al-Quds over the past few weeks, killing and injuring dozens and arresting scores more during their raids. However, Palestinians this time have resorted to retaliatory operations targeting Israelis in Tel Aviv and its suburbs. Tensions escalated after an Israeli decision to expand the settler units on the occupied land. That prompted more retaliatory operations in different cities. With more than 7 decades of occupation and the regime's defiance of UN resolutions and international laws, many believe a new era of Palestinian resistance has just begun.
Naturally, that was the response of our youngsters who has waited more than 30 years for the international community to move and to stop those crimes of Israeli and those atrocities of Israeli army against our children and our nation. Today, these missions and these operations, they are the actual response to those who are talking about normalization of relation with Israel, that criminal regime who has to be punished rather not to be rewarded with this normalization.
Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, have already hailed the operations against the regime. They have also vowed that the Israeli rampage would not go unanswered. Tensions have been growing ever since Israel embarked on the process to normalize ties with several Arab states, including Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Morocco. Palestinians describe the process a stab in their back. To add to the fuel further, Israel recently hosted a summit of foreign ministers of these Arab governments, as well as Egypt and the United States in the occupied Negev Desert. But will such a policy ever benefit Israel while it continues cracking down on Palestinians and ignoring their rights of survival?
So it'll be interesting to see how their own peoples treat this alliance. I think the clock is ticking on these countries in terms of their own street, their own masses. And I think revolution is just around the corner.
The regime's cruel policies, including its provocations at Islam's third holiest site in Al-Quds, as well as fatal shootings of innocent Palestinians, prove that it has never been in favor of peace. Now, it has tightened its grip on the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Over a dozen Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed in the past 2 weeks. Palestinians say they have no other option but to resist the Israeli occupation and crimes it's been committing almost on a daily basis. It seems the normalization deals and bloody crackdowns have backfired, putting Israel at an unprecedented risk instead of ensuring its security.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, international coordinator, Samuddin Palestinian Prisoners to Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, activist and commentator Nick Napier joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Charlotte Cates. Looking just at what has occurred, another Palestinian to have succumbed to his wounds today in Jenin, and you have basically the number of Palestinians killed since Sunday to 4 in what appears to be a free hand given to the Israeli security forces to do what they want, pretty much, just a green light coming from the prime minister.
Absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing is an attempt to crush the ongoing Palestinian resistance, particularly targeting Jenin and Jenin camp. It's a resistance that has never been destroyed. And it's important to note that we're actually looking at the 20th anniversary of the previous massive assault on Jenin camp by the Israeli occupation, the Great Battle of Jenin, which was an occasion of vast atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation. And then there's a film called Jenin Jenin, which portrays these, very factually in a very moving way. But it also is a site of great resistance, and of a resistance that despite normalization, despite Oslo, despite the Palestinian Authority, and despite, massive imprisonment and targeting against the Palestinian resistance, has never been crushed. And so what we're seeing in this assault that's taking place in Jenin, in this wholesale killing and execution of Palestinian civilians as well as resistance fighters, I mean, for example, we saw them taking the lives of children as well as the lives of a nearly blind woman simply attempting to cross the street just yesterday, that in addition to these massive crimes that are taking place against the Palestinian people, what we are also seeing in Jenin is the fact that Palestinian resistance has not yet been killed despite 74 years of Nakba and cannot be killed. And so Jenin is not just a symbol of destruction, but also a symbol of the fact that Palestinians resistance continues to uphold humanity in the face of all kinds of violence that is backed up by the most powerful regimes and states in the world, and that all those, particularly in the Western countries whose governments are continuing to provide aid and support, including military aid and deals with the Israeli regime, take action, build the boycott, come into the streets to stand with the Palestinian people in Jenin, in Gaza, throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea, sure, and their resistance.
I'm sifting through some of the deaths that have occurred here, making that appear. One of them stands out, which is not reported that widely, no surprise there, and that's about the person by the name of Sanad, 16 years old, Israeli forces shooting this person in the chest with live ammunition as he approached a Palestinian man who had been shot to offer aid. This would be the fifth Palestinian child shot and killed by Israeli forces for this year, which gives credence to what the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has said, who has said there will not be any limits for this war. We are granting full freedom of action to the army, the Shin Bet, and all security forces. Some are rightly concluding, if you agree, with that being a green light for Israeli forces to kill, including extrajudicial killings. Do you agree?
I only have one slight disagreement. The Israeli killing of Palestinians is permanently barbaric. I mean, the United Nations Human Rights Council, during the Great March of Return, published a report saying that it was a very blunt report. They said that Israeli snipers were killing health workers, journalists, and children, knowing that they were journalists and health workers and children. So this is not so much a green light as a call to intensify the repression. They've always had a green light. I mean, a group called Breaking the Silence, Israeli soldiers, quite, they're quite many ways. But the story of occupation forces do, Palestinians, barbaric. One is when bored at a checkpoint, each of them, Palestinian man to the ground, angle him, throttle. And the one who's Palestinian the longest time to be business wins this. Now, this is public knowledge. And the killing of journalists, of not just, but the killing of
Israeli military. I'm going to unfortunately jump in here. We're getting you broken up. The audio connection is not working right. So we'll give the tech people a little bit of time to fix that before I come back to you. Charlotte Cates, it was very surprising to hear another statement coming from Naftali Bennett. This comes after what happened in Tel Aviv, which was called a heroic action of a resistance operation that was executed. He said that now Israel is moving from a state of self-defense to a state of attack. Now, when you hear that, it goes against what we know Israel is doing on the ground, which is basically violating Palestinian rights. And it seems like they are always on the offensive. Why is it that Israel thinks that, and then you have either the U.S. or the European Union or allies of Israel that actually believe that, at least that's what they're showing the world? What do you think about the statement made there by Naftali Bennett?
Well, of course, I mean, it's laughing in the face of reality. It's a complete slap in the face to any look at reality, which is that it's impossible for Israel, so-called Israel, to ever be engaged in self-defense. Because the fact is that the Israeli regime is built on the dispossession and destruction and attempted destruction of the Palestinian people from their land. It's a fundamentally illegitimate project. There is no such thing as legitimate self-defense of the colonizer to keep its colonial regime intact. Instead, it is the fact that people who are living under colonization and people who are living under occupation have the right to resist, have the right to struggle for freedom. And so this is exactly what we're seeing take place. Now, it is certainly true that the resistance is exposing the fact that this facade, this mirage of so-called Israeli security, the fact is that all of these billions of dollars of high-powered surveillance and spy technology that Israel makes more billions of dollars marketing to repressive regimes around the world, including its imperialist partners in crime in the United States, the UK, Canada, and Europe, that all of this so-called security technology cannot stop an indigenous people from continuing to resist, continuing to fight back, continuing to seek freedom despite all odds, and that it is only bringing an end to injustice, something that the Israeli regime never wants to do, that actually can bring about real peace and justice.
Very well. Mick Knapp here, if you want to continue with where you left off, you can do that, unless you want me to ask you another question.
No, that's okay. I think that anyone who looks at a map of Palestine since 48 can see that not a day goes by or a month or a week without Israel stealing more land. And the founding fathers of Zionism were very clear, Jabotinsky, for example, that this could only be achieved by tremendous violence, that there's no example in the history of the world of a native people giving up their homeland to invaders, to colonizers, without resistance. And the greater the resistance, the greater the violence that needs to be to them. So it's very difficult actually to say something new when there's a new atrocity, except to say this, that the more the Palestinians resist, the greater will have to be the horror of the Zionist project. And we've seen report after damning report, they're endless. Every few years we get one that says Israel's a barbaric state, which is committed to the dispossession of all the native people and driving them into Jordan or somewhere else, and replacing them with Zionist Jews from around the world. And when the Palestinians resist, they are resisting colonialism. I mean, what is colonization? It's naked violence. It's an anachronism. After the great anti-colonial movements of the end of the 20th century, Israel is out of time. There's no other project, perhaps with the exception of Myanmar, where the Rohingya Muslims are being expelled, are being driven from their homeland. And by the way, the UN has recently described that activity as genocide. nothing the Myanmar junta has done to the Rohingya Muslims has not been done by Israel to the Palestinians. If you call one genocide, and we should, then what Israel's doing to the Palestinians is a kind of slow motion genocide as well. So the resistance is not just supported by the Geneva Convention. It's supported by any ethical system in the history of the human race. The right to resist this brutal regime which Zionism consists of. There is no subtlety in what the Zionists do. It is the application of violence. It's the application of greater violence whenever that produces resistance. And they have been very consistent about that. And, okay. You know, if the Palestinians seek a legal way out of it, Donald Trump said if anyone dared to take Israel to the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, America would apply tremendous sanctions against them, and Europe complied with that. So the Palestinians have won legal decisions. It's just over 12 years ago, the Israeli apartheid wall was ruled by one of the international courts to be a crime. And every Western government which subscribed to the court was instructed to take action to support the Palestinians, to have the wall dismantled and to seek restitution. What did Britain and the other states do? Increased their arms sales to Israel. So the Palestinians have tried everything. The resistance needs to be supported. There are many ways to resist. For some people, it's the heroism of armed resistance. But there are many forms of resistance, popular resistance, across the West Bank and across 1948. Gaza. So that resistance has a call upon our solidarity. If they did not resist, it would be pathological. It would be something shameful.
All right. Let's break down this entry with you, Charlotte Cates, because it cleverly wants to portray a scenario about Palestinians. And I'm going to read through it. It reads, "The current surge in terrorist attacks, as it calls it, in Israel, has been framed by Palestinian parties and militant groups as a logical consequence of the entrenchment of Israel's 55-year occupation of the West Bank and of Israel's control over sensitive religious sites." And it goes on and on. Now, the thing here is it calls what happened in Israel, that terrorists are doing that. It calls Palestinian militant groups. But at the same time, it's acknowledging that there is a point that has been broken by the Palestinians in terms of how the rights are being obviously violated. What do you think of that? Do you think that there is an acknowledgement, but yet Palestinians are still being accused of what's happening?
Well, it is certainly the case that the United States government and the mainstream corporate media and other imperialist powers, they are fully and fundamentally aware of the reality of what the Zionist project is. They are not under the impression that it is something other than an illegitimate apartheid racist settler colonial project. It has always been the case of those who hold power unjustly and through colonization and exploitation and oppression of others, that all of those who fight back against that colonization and oppression and exploitation are deemed terrorists. And of course, this is a term when terror is far more aptly applied to the monumental and monstrous state violence that is constantly visited upon the indigenous people of Palestine who are struggling to retain their land and return to their land despite 74, not 55 years of occupation, colonization, and Nakba. There has been an attempt to obscure that reality from the eyes of people around the world. And this is certainly an attempt in which all of these imperialist governments and the corporate mainstream media have been fully complicit. But when people can simply turn on their computers and see for themselves, despite all the censorship taking place on social media platforms, see from Palestinians the reality of life under occupation and colonization and the reality of Israeli brutality and barbarism, that people cannot be lied to anymore. And so there is sort of this acknowledgement of this reality, but an attempt to suppress that resistance that seeks to bring that horrendous reality to an end by all means. And so it's really important that we stand against this classification of Palestinian resistance as terrorism. In fact, there's been an attempt to expand the scope of terrorism, where even doing so much as advocating for Palestinian farmers to maintain their land and representing Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli military courts is being labeled as terrorist activity as well. The real terror is that which is created by imperialism and Zionism, and the Palestinian resistance is a justified, legitimate force that all people who care about justice should support.
Sure. Mick Napier, the attacks that happened, the two most recent attacks in Tel Aviv and another one in an area by the name of Brak. They were carried out by Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. No claim of responsibility at this point. And you have Palestinian groups that have not claimed responsibility. And based on a senior military official of Israel, he said that no evidence that this was masterminded by a major Palestinian group, which then leads one to maybe conclude, if you think, that the level of occupation has reached such epic proportions that it is leading maybe Palestinians who are not affiliated to anybody to just go out and commit such acts. Do you think that it has reached that level?
Well, yes. When you put people in such a pressure cooker, when every Palestinian who approaches a checkpoint depends upon the mood of a lance corporal or a sergeant or anybody in an Israeli uniform, whether he or she will be allowed to proceed to their work, to go to their family, to go to a clinic, or will be detained for 3 or 4 hours, or will be turned back and denied something that they need. When this life is forced upon Palestinians, where the lowest soldier at the checkpoint is simply there to humiliate and takes every opportunity to humiliate, then resistance is inevitable. Because Palestinians, unlike Algerians or unlike Vietnamese, live in a terrible prison, completely surrounded by Israel, controlling every entry point, and it really is a gigantic prison. In that situation, Israel has tremendous power. It has fantastic surveillance. It can blackmail Palestinians to become collaborators. You want to have your mother be allowed to go to a hospital for a life-saving operation? Become a collaborator. We have something that you'd be very embarrassed about. Become a collaborator or we'll tell your neighbors. So in that situation, the ability of the Israelis to infiltrate, to understand, to be able to subvert coherent resistance movements, it's not perfect, but it's very great indeed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, individual Palestinians sometimes just reach a breaking point. When they cannot organize collectively, they will strike out individually. And it's absolutely inevitable. By the way, the Israelis know it's inevitable. This talk of terrorism is just a mask. And, I'm reminded of every single anti-colonial movement has been designated as terrorist, as savage, as barbaric, and every possible invective is hurled against them. The reality is that it's an anti-colonial movement. It's noble. It's just. And all the decent people of the world, I mean all, actually support the Palestinians. They may be majorities in some places and large minorities in others, but they support the Palestinians. Okay. And look at who's lined up with the Israelis. It really doesn't bear examination. Can I just say one thing? I'm reminded of the Spanish conquistador, Castellanos. He said of the people in the Caribbean, "We call them cannibals." It comes from the word Carib. "We call them cannibals because they defend their villages very strongly and they refuse to be enslaved." So the Palestinians are called terrorists? Of course they are. But Israel is a terrorist state. And you know something? When the European Union is forced to apologize to Israel for the opinions of its citizens, we know what side we're on. And Israel knows it's in a crisis. If I just say one more thing, the Palestinians, through their struggle, have already won a crucial battle against Israel. Israel is deeply unpopular worldwide. And that's why the BDS movement is able to grow and will continue to grow in line with and parallel with Palestinian resistance.
Thank you for that. From Edinburgh, Mick Napier, their activist and commentator. Charlotte Cates, thank you for your insight from Vancouver. International Coordinator, Samidoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who gave us her insight. Okay, that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tahway and the entire team, is goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلَّ وَلَوْ شَاءَ لَجَعَلَهُ سَاكِنًا ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَا الشَّمْسَ عَلَيْهِ دَلِيلًا
Have you not considered your Lord, how He extends the shadow, and if He willed, He could have made it stationary? Then we made the sun for it an indication.
Brothers and sisters, previously, we started to discuss this 45th verse of the chapter, Chapter Furqan. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلَّ وَلَوْ شَاءَ لَجَعَلَهُ سَاكِنًا ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَا الشَّمْسَ عَلَيْهِ دَلِيلًا Have you not seen the might of your Lord, how He expands the shadow? And if He had pleased, He would certainly have made it stationary. Then we have made the sun an indication of it. Also, the 46th one states, ثُمَّ قَبَضُنَاهُ إِلَيْنَا قَبْضًا يَسِيرًا Then we draw it in towards ourselves by an easy contraction. As you might remember, in the previous episode, we discussed the different possible meanings and concepts regarding the word shadow. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلِ The word dhil. And we concluded that the meanings we said earlier are conforming with the rest and continuation of the verse. There are some indications that the first commentary is more proper. The one that says this spread and vast shade is the one which is covering the earth between the dawn and the rising of the sun, which is by far the most pleasant shade and hours of the day. The reason why we claim so is that the verse continues and says, then we have made the sun an indication of it. ثُمَّ جَعَلْنَا الشَّمْسَ عَلَيْهِ دَلِيلًا. This refers to the fact that if there was not the sun, the concept of shade would not be clear. Basically, shade is formed by the rays of the sun, because shade is usually partial darkness that happens for objects. It happens when the light is cast on an impassable object, and in front of it, a shade will be formed. So we must not only know shade by light, according to the law that says no objects by their opposites, but also the existence of shade is caused by light. Anyway, this argument ends here.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
What we generally understand from this verse is that it starts with the words Alam Tara, and in this case continues talking about how the Almighty Allah has caused shade on the earth. This means one of the best ways to recognize Allah more, to have better cognizance of Him, is to think and ponder on the different creatures in the world. And in this case, this phenomena of existence, which is clearly formed based on His knowledge. And the fact is, we are drowned in the blessings and creations of the Almighty Allah. But we have not taken a close look at them. By having this kind of approach that says, أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلِ, have we not taken a look at this fact that if there were longer periods of light in the universe, there wouldn't be some time for the creations for rest, and they would all die? We could have never known our God, the Creator, better. Although our Lord has the power and ability to create everything in its own way, by saying kun fayakun, He will say to it be and it will be, but He has a kind of special tradition and sunnah for everything. As the verse says, وَلَوْ شَاءَ لَجَعَلَهُ سَاكِنًا. He could have done this. If He had pleased, He would have made it stationary, but He didn't. This is His own tradition and sunnah on this earth, and this is how He is dealing with all the creatures. They have to move on, they have to move and start this path toward the Lord by themselves. He has the ability to have this kind of vast change in the universe, but he has his own sunnah, because the verse says, وَلَوْ شَاءَ لَجَعَلَهُ سَاكِنًا. And this is what we have to know. Based on this verse, we have to look at everything with its special relation to Almighty Allah. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلْ. This verb, مَدَّ, is used in singular form, referring to the cause, which is the absolute cause, our Lord. Then he says, جَعَلْنَا الشَّمْسَ عَلَيْهِ دَلِيلًا. We did it. We are the ones that are doing this. And also the next verse that says, قَبَضْنَا. The verse says, we draw it towards ourselves. We are the one doing it. And this is the kind of approach that we must take all in our lives. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallophabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Roman Mazahari, Paris.
On
Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
As voters go to the first-round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate.
In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Savile for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Savile seems surprising.
Remarkable that they didn't call upon the services of a professional PR company and they sought the services of Jimmy Savile. It just goes to show the lack of judgment and the lack of understanding of the potential for this kind of blowback when they cavort with these celebrities, not knowing anything about their background or not even trying to look into their background before they do so. We are talking about the royal family after all, aren't we?
These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without at a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps. The association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
Just days after a UN-backed truce came into force in Yemen, fears have risen over the implementation of the agreement, with key promises regarding commercial flights being allowed to enter Sana'a's international airport failing to materialize so far. At the time of the UN announcement, senior Yemeni officials warned onlookers to remain cautious about raising their hopes prematurely. Despite the warning, many Yemenis have already become excited for an end to the war.
The truce is wonderful for us and the region in general, a great thing, and we hope that the truce will last not only for 2 months, but rather permanently, because the people are tired and they have suffered a lot.
Yemenis have faced their fair share of disappointment over the years in regards to peace efforts. Multiple nationwide ceasefires have all failed, and the 2018 peace talks hosted by Sweden also failed to produce an end to the conflict. However, experts still believe the flights will begin soon.
The truce is holding very well. Reports of violations do not amount to breaking the truce. It's the usual standard violations that take place in similar situations. The Saudis have been trying to get out of this quagmire for a long time. And the big major conference in Riyadh is their way to initiate the exit out of the Yemen conflict. So I'm very hopeful that this will lead to some major break in the Yemeni conflict.
This truce, which the United Nations is already celebrating, could turn into a curse rather than a blessing for millions of Yemenis if key pledges regarding the siege are not upheld. In particular, so many will be hoping that they can finally get into Yemen to visit their besieged loved ones. If that turns out not to be the case, then it would be another additional heartbreak on top of the many already broken hearts which have been caused by this devastating conflict. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's nuclear energy program has redefined the country's domestic and foreign policies since the country indigenized the industry. Every year on April 9th, Iran showcases the latest nuclear achievements to mark National Nuclear Technology Day. With President Ebrahim Raisi in attendance, the ceremony this year saw the unveiling of 9 new products out of a total of 77 pieces of nuclear-related equipment produced recently. The president boasted that Iran's nuclear advances were made while the country was under Western pressure.
They didn't want us to have our own domestic nuclear industry. They tried their best to stop us. They assassinated our nuclear scientists. They imposed sanctions and even targeted our nuclear facilities with explosions. But here we are treading our path toward greater success in the nuclear industry.
Today, we have extended our nuclear know-how to an extent that we can use it in a range of industries such as agriculture and health, such as radio medicine. We will generate 10,000 megawatts of nuclear-powered electricity and are planning to build an entirely domestic 360-megawatt nuclear power plant.
The event comes as Iran and the world powers are wrapping up talks over the revival of the 2015 deal, which promised Tehran sanctions relief in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The accord has faced trouble since the U.S. unilaterally left it in 2018 and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. That prompted Iran and other signatories to the accord to launch the Vienna talks to fix the ailing deal.
You know, we have already finished the discussions and negotiation there. As you have heard from our foreign minister, it is time for decision. They have to make difficult decision. That depends, of course, to them to decide if really they want to come back to